Macaulay Dane. But when I read him my junior year, I thought he was hilarious. He's so funny. There's so many jokes and there's so many pointed jabs, and he's very critical of society, and his criticism of 19th century Denmark is still very apropos for our particular generation. So I found him just to be very engaging and lively and very fun. He is also a very literary philosopher. He considered himself to be a poet. And so he wrote in various styles. So he wrote kind of very classical, kind of speculative philosophy in some of his works. And other works are read more like novels. He wrote under pseudonyms, so he did all kinds of playful kinds of literary things. He wrote some aphorisms. And I'm presenting these parables so that we don't have to talk about a particularly long text, that we can actually see some of his central concerns in these very short passages that are excerpted from longer pieces. Kierkegaard's central question is, what is it to be a self? And this is very different from the kind of philosophy that preceded him, that was interested in universal claims about the nature of man, or about the history of intellectual thought through time and how it unfolded. So for example, for Hegel, it begins with art and it moves through religion, then ends in philosophy, and not surprisingly, all history ends in his philosophy, right? So we have Enlightenment thinkers who are concerned about epistemological questions about what kinds of things that we can know and about the nature of reality. And Kierkegaard was more interested in, who am I and what should I be doing, right? Very concrete kinds of questions. And so one of his central kind of mottos is, you know, stop talking about things and just do them, right? If you really mean something or value something, you'll show it in your actions, not just by giving lip service to it. So his central question is, what is to be a self? And he really marked this new era in intellectual history. He came after the Enlightenment thinkers, who believed that reason was the ultimate kind of pinnacle, that they were going to free themselves from the shackles of the clergy. They broke away, and they thought, the Enlightenment thinkers, for example, Kant, thought that they were ushering in a new age of freedom, of moral responsibility, and they were going to save mankind through the powers of reason. And then we see with David Hume, for example, that there are limits to reason, and so that project crumbled and gave rise to the Romantics, who believed that reason should be discarded, that it was really emotion that should be reigning supreme. And so Kierkegaard comes after both of these different groups who favor reason and favor emotion. And so he tries to figure out some way of putting them together. So sometimes Kierkegaard is criticized as being an irrationalist or an irrationalist philosopher, because he says things like subjectivity is truth. And a lot of people are confused by what that could possibly mean. And he's not saying that you can just make up truth, but he's saying that subjectivity is truth because when you believe something is true, you live it out. And so by the appropriating of something, you are acknowledging that to be something that's true, right? If you give it that kind of a meaning. So I think there are two really important reasons why Kierkegaard is significant. And I was talking to Glenn about this a little bit today at the kiosk. Where's Glenn? I thought I saw him. Hi, Glenn. One thing that Kierkegaard does really well is he answers the question of, what does it mean to have faith in this particular age? One in which faith is really challenged by the claims of secularism, pluralism, and all of these various kinds of issues. And I think he's the philosopher who really answers that in a meaningful and substantive way. And he also is important because he tries to answer how to communicate across divides. This is something that we've been talking about in our other sessions, particularly when we were talking about Plato's cave allegory. If people have different and competing views of truth, how can you get them to talk with each other? And this is something that I think Kierkegaard does really remarkably well. So the passages that I have for you here today are three parables that are all on the same kind of theme. And I, when we were at Vespers just now, I was thinking how they're related to what we're talking about in terms of sharing, generosity, that all three of these are tied together with a theme of having high aspirations for ourselves, not settling for mediocrity or just kind of wallowing in normalcy, or allowing us to be kind of pulled along by the crowd. But to have these kinds of high goals, high aims, and particularly within our spiritual life. So the first one is called the rigorous coachman. The second one is the cellar tenant, and there's an illustration that goes with it. These first two are taken from a book that is called Kierkegaard's Parables. It's just a book of the parables that have been collected together. And then the last one that I'm presenting to you is the wild goose, and this is Howard Hahn's favorite metaphor. And then below that, I have the tame goose. You can read that on your own for later if you wish.
Does Holden have a copy of this book?
No. I went into the library, and there are some Kierkegaard texts, but there aren't any of Howard Hahn's translations that I was able to find. But the Kierkegaard Parables one is of Kierkegaard's life, 1813 to 1855. And actually, just as an interesting side note, this year marks the 200th anniversary of his birth. It was on May 15th, and there have been celebratory events all over because of it this year. So in May, there was a huge event in Copenhagen. The Queen attended, and there were scholars from all over the world at that event. And then St. Olaf College is holding a large conference at the end of the month, and I'll be there. And it will, scholars from Korea and South America, and I think Israel. And
so he died as a very young man.
What's that?
He died as
a very
young man. He
did, and he had a very unusual and sad life. Just a real brief biography. His father was a dry goods salesperson in Copenhagen. I think he had inherited his uncle's business. So Kierkegaard self-published all of his works, and I think only one of them made any money. So he lived off of his inheritance. He didn't ever have a job. He thought about being a pastor for some time, but he was drawn back into his authorship because of ridicule that he'd received from a newspaper. And so he felt he had to defend himself, and then he entered into what is called a second authorship. But he had kind of an ill-fated romance and an engagement that was broken off, that a lot of people have made a big deal of in terms of his writings. And I believe that he sunk into some kind of mental illness at the end of his life. And then he died, he collapsed in the street actually, and had some kind of spinal paralysis and was in the hospital for a couple of weeks, and then just died at 43 or something like that. His he had seven, there were seven children in his family, and only his brother survived him, Peter, who ended up becoming a bishop of the church in Denmark. And their relationship was so strained at the end of Kierkegaard's life that he refused to see his brother on his deathbed. His brother wanted to come and give him communion, and he refused it because he saw him as being a representative of the church. And so Kierkegaard was kind of despised in Copenhagen during his lifetime because he criticized Grundtvig and Hans Christian Andersen, who were seen as cultural heroes. And he was seen as kind of an oddball, the way he dressed, and so people made fun of him. And even to this day, some Danes that I talk to think it's bizarre that I'm interested in him because he was so, they like Hans Christian Andersen and Grundtvig. And at the end of his life, all of his writings became very highly polemical, critical writings against the church. He was really upset with what he called Christendom, which was kind of the churchy expression of false religion. And he juxtaposed that against what he saw was true Christianity. So in Denmark, the state church was the Lutheran church. And if you were born Danish, you were born Lutheran. And he thought that that was wrong. And so, yeah, he had a very kind of sad, lonely existence, and I think that really shaped his writings. So let's go ahead and we'll look at the first one, the rigorous coachman. Would somebody be willing to read it out loud? Thanks, Penny.
Of what is the human spirit capable? Once upon a time, there was a rich man who ordered from abroad at a high price a pair of entirely faultless and high-bred horses, which he desired to have for his own pleasure and for the pleasure of driving them himself. Then about a year or two elapsed. Anyone who previously had known these horses would not have been able to recognize them again, Their eyes had become dull and drowsy. Their gait lacked style and decision. They couldn't endure anything. They couldn't hold out. They hardly could be driven 4 miles without having to stop on the way. Sometimes they came to a standstill as he sat for all he was... As he sat for all he was worth attempting to drive them. Besides, they had acquired all sorts of vices and bad habits. And in spite of the fact that they, of course, got fodder in overabundance, they were falling off in flesh day by day. Then he had the king's coachman called. He drove them for a month. In the whole region, there was not a pair of horses that held their heads so proudly, whose glance was so fiery, whose gait was so handsome, no other pair of horses that could hold out so long, though it were to trot for more than a score of miles at a stretch without stopping. How came this about? It is easy to see. The owner, who, without being a coachman, pretended to be such, drove them in accordance with the horse's understanding of what it is to drive. The royal coachman drove them in accordance with the coachman's understanding of what it is to drive. So it is with us men. Oh, when I think of myself and of the countless men I have learnt to know, I have often said to myself despondently, here are talents and powers and capacities enough, but the coachman is lacking. Through a long period of time, we men from generation to generation have been, if I may say so, driven to stick to the figure in accordance with the horse's understanding of what it is to drive. We are directed, brought up, educated in accordance with man's conception of what it is to be a man. Behold, therefore, what we lack. Exaltation, and what follows in turn from this, that we only can stand so little, impatiently employ at once the means of the instant, and in our impatience desire instantly to see the reward of our labor, which just for this reason is deferred. Once it was different. Once there was a time when it pleased the deity, if I may venture to say so, to be himself the coachman, and he drove the horses in accordance with the coachman's understanding of what it is to drive. Oh, what was a man not capable of at this time?
So parables are a particular kind of literary form that uses typically human figures, if it uses animal figures, it's often called a fable, to give us some kind of instructive lesson, give us some kind of moral. And so when we read these, we want to figure out what it is that he's saying. Now, I have to be completely honest, and I have no idea what he's talking about when he says, here, there once was a time when it pleased the deity to be himself the coachman, and he drove the horses in accordance with the coachman's understanding of what it is to drive. He's looking back here to some previous time that he thinks was more true to what he thinks should have been done. And I don't know what time he's referring to. But I wonder what you think here of this symbol here. What is it that we're supposed to learn from this image of the coachman and these horses?
You know, when I read that, though, that actually strikes me as being one of the most... To me, that's kind of
the clearest part.
It's clear, yeah. To me, I think about that too. I think about when you look back at Abraham and Isaac. God was much more intimately, day by day, in conversation with. It wasn't a still small voice that you were thinking maybe you heard. There were revelations, and there were miracles, and there were burning bushes, and there was Noah, and there was. Nineveh, and there was all that stuff where God was much more hands-on.
Where he was
and
cracking the whip.
He definitely let it be known whether he liked what they were doing or what they weren't. If he favored somebody, he favored them. And when they ticked him off, he let them know. That was when Israel was great, maybe.
I think it's...
It's
kind of like like hedonism. You know, where man sets his own standards, and
yes,
they might sleep in and not have, get much done, and at the end of the day they don't have very much to feel good about themselves, as compared to living up to God's standard for us and, rolling out of bed and working hard, and at the end of the day being able to hold your head high and feeling good about what you accomplished in the day.
Yes, and for Kierkegaard, strenuousness is a concept that comes up over and over again, right? So we can think of strenuousness of labor. Right? I think here he has in mind the strenuousness of being a self, or being a self before God. And so one of the things that Kierkegaard says famously is that, being a Christian is task enough for you. It's easy to criticize everybody else for not being Christian enough or in the right way or whatever. He says, stop worrying about them. your task of being one is enough to occupy you for an entire lifetime if you take it seriously. And that that task is a strenuous task that has to be taken up over and over again all the time.
Like, right? Your own standards might be low, but if you use God's standards for yourself, you're going to shoot higher and achieve more.
Yes.
And there's so many people now that are making their own religion, taking a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of that, but they don't really have a higher power to guide their lives or to set the limits.
Yes. And in Kierkegaard's time, when everybody was assumed to be Lutheran, he said even within the same tradition of the Lutheran tradition, that there was a watering down of the words so that the strenuousness of the demand placed on those words wasn't as challenging for people. So that the language actually became trivialized and demeaned by the way that it was used.
You got all of that out of that word.
I got all of it, and I got more.
But I hear the message in there that I hear concerning where we are with our society today, that we've abandoned the concept of delayed gratification and are demanding everything instantly.
Yes.
I heard that loud and clear in there, that
yeah.
there was a demand for instant satisfaction and
right.
The failure to accept it. Sometimes we have to realize that, that delayed gratification is probably far more important.
Right. And actually, for Kierkegaard, he believes that suffering is something that's really good.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that we should be pursuing happiness, however happiness can be defined. And philosophers define it lots of different ways, right? It can be simply a hedonistic kind of thing, or it can be an Aristotelian notion of flourishing, right? But that kind of a notion might have to include some kind of sense of suffering or delayed gratification so that the flourishing can take place fully.
But,
yeah.
But he didn't, I mean, the suffering was a purposeful suffering.
Yes.
And it was what you were suffering for, not...
For its own sake, right.
Right.
Yeah.
So the striving is for what?
So... For Kierkegaard, so the next one will help us talk about the different, what he calls the stages or spheres of life. He believes that life is a maturation process, and really the ultimate goal is to be one, a Christian who lives out ethically what the Christian demand is. And for Kierkegaard, it's imitation of Christ and love of neighbor. So those are the things that we strive to do. And he is very explicit about the neighbor is the faceless person, is everybody. And it has nothing to do with preferential love. It has nothing to do with proximity. That's not neighbor. Neighbor is everybody. Like as you were saying, it includes the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And this the strenuousness, the demand, the striving of constantly to understand the agape love that includes everyone.
So it's not a self-aggrandizement, you know, the striving to be better or to achieve.
No, and actually a lot of it is the humbling of self.
Okay.
The striving includes
okay.
a kind of a severe humbling of self.
Okay.
Infinite humiliation and infinite grace and then a gratitude born of striving. That's his definition of Christianity.
Say that again.
Infinite humiliation and infinite grace and then a striving born of gratitude. So it begins with repentance and then the act of grace. And then the striving is something that's done in response to the act of grace.
You know, I think the U.S. politicians ought to read this. They might understand that they're only about themselves instead of about everybody else. I think they missed the boat.
Okay, so let's go to the next one. This is the cellar tenant. This one I think is really interesting. Would somebody be willing to read this one?
What happened to Perlander?
Oh, I don't have that one there. I don't have the entire one.
Oh,
so
I'm
the next
one.
Yeah, it was just included on that page
because
of the book.
a stellar tenet, to what shall we compare our persistent spiritual self-rejection? In case one were to think of a house consisting of cellar, ground floor, and premier étage, so tenanted, or rather so arranged that it was planned for a distinction of rank between the dwellers on the several floors, and in case one were to make a comparison between such a house and what it is to be a man, then unfortunately this is the sorry and ludicrous condition of the majority of men, that in their own house they prefer to live in the cellar. The soulish bodily synthesis in every man is planned with a view to being spirit. Such is the building. But the man prefers to dwell in the cellar, that is, in the determinants of sensuousness. And not only does he prefer to dwell in the cellar, no, he loves that to such a degree that he becomes furious if anyone would propose to him to occupy the bel étage, which stands empty at his disposition, for in fact he is dwelling in his own house.
So in his writings, particularly the early ones in the first authorship, so he talks about what are called the stages or spheres of existence, and according to the kind of traditional model, there are three. The first is the aesthetic stage, where somebody lives in immediacy, where they're constantly fleeting from pleasure to pleasure. And then the second stage is the ethical life, where people recognize that they're free and that they have a moral obligation to other people. And so they have to follow through on those promises. And so it provides some kind of grounding for them that they can't just be fleeting from sensuous moment to the next sensuous moment, but that they actually have some kind of higher obligation on themselves. And then the third stage for him is the religious stage that's marked by paradox, and the central paradox for Kierkegaard is the God-man, in other words, Jesus, the paradox that Jesus was both fully God and fully man at the same time, that this is not something that can be comprehended through reason, but it has to be embraced. And so Kierkegaard often is associated with what is called the leap of faith. That's kind of what people think of when they think of Kierkegaard, the leap of faith. But that's actually not something he ever wrote about. He refers to something like it, but it was actually an idea by an earlier German thinker named Lessing about kind of crossing these divides where there's no reason to do it. You just have to do it in order to get over there, because that's where you want to be. But it's the thought is that nobody can argue you in or out of a religious position by using logical argumentation or persuasion, that it's something that you have to just decide. And so so there are these three stages, the aesthetic, the ethical, and the religious. And according to the traditional view, most people believe that Kierkegaard was trying to say that our life is a progression through those stages, right? That it's a maturation through those things. But actually, his writings show that there's actually a life is about a waffling between all of them. And actually, after the religious stage, some scholars are saying now, there's actually a second ethics and a second aesthetic stage that where you understand the ethical and you understand the immediacy or pleasure in a different way after you've made some kind of religious movement or act of resignation to God. Which I think is true, and I think that he doesn't think that once you've climbed one ladder, you can throw it away and be at the next stage and stay there, but that life is this constant movement through these different spheres. But this passage here is talking to us about these three levels in our own house, and we live in the basement. And here we have a picture of the guy who's living in his basement, that it's most comfortable to be down there. And that if somebody challenges you, go to the front, that you can rationalize yourself, this is why I want to be down here. It's comfortable, it's familiar. I like it, it's serving my needs at the moment.
I think it's a man cave.
Yeah. I like his top hat, right? He's all by himself in his top hat.
He's probably
a mess on the floor. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So you said Kierkegaard would say that the individual decides to move up to this stage. Would he put any...
This is a difficult question, right? Because the writings are challenging because it seems like that this is something that is given by grace, right? Because how do we do it ourselves? Because then that would be an act of self-willing, and then we can say, well, can we really will ourselves to be fully Christian,
right? So does
right?
he discuss
so,
that, or is
yes.
he pretty much okay?
Yes, and I think that's a really challenging topic in his writings. Is it about you making the movement, or is it about God making the movement happen within you? And I think that's a really kind of challenging piece, because he goes both ways in different pieces. And another challenge with Kierkegaard is that he writes under pseudonyms, and so a lot of these ideas are taken from characters that he's created that he thinks represent different places along these stages. So he says, for example, Johannes Climacus, one of the pseudonyms, is lower than what Kierkegaard thinks where he is. But there's another character named Anticlimacus who he thinks has gone further than himself. And so we have all of these different imaginary characters who are representative of all of these different places that we can be. This one I think is so interesting because he's talking about it being our own house and our own choice. And so therefore we're somehow responsible for being in the cellar. Any other thoughts about this one?
Well, this is my first philosophy class in my whole 67 years, so I don't have a clue. But it's interesting.
How would the German Lutherans respond to it? Because they're sort of drinking their beer down there. So.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the thing that you were just talking about, I think that in Kierkegaard, I think there's a real tension between life as being something that is about striving and life being something as a gift. And in his journals, he says it's both. And so his writings reflect both of those things. So you have somebody like Bonhoeffer, for example, who says, you know, you can't have cheap grace, you have to do something, right? If the demand is to, you know, face the Nazis or to look Hitler in the eye, right, then you have to do something about it, right? You can't just be immobile there and hope something good happens.
Is the basement kind of like our understanding of our world, and basic, and the upper stories would be more the spiritual thing? So because we don't really understand spiritual things, we'd rather be living in the basement, at least we understand the reason, you know,
yes,
as compared to things that, you know, we don't understand, so we don't want to go there?
Yes, I think it can represent all sorts of things. I think that's one thing, and I think that's why Kierkegaard is so critical of philosophers of his time, because he thinks that they're just kind of clamping down on the things that are easy to understand, and so we have philosophy in that time period being kind of subjugated to the sciences, for example. Well, here, we can take this to the lab and test it, and here we can all agree on what the answer is, and then we don't have any difficulties. Whereas if we deal with other kinds of questions where we have different answers to, then we kind of want to say, well, I don't want to approach that or deal with that.
You're saying, though, that his work kind of contrasted reason, you know, and to me that's
yes.
kind of what the basement is.
Yes, and I think he would say that the Enlightenment thinkers are down there, or even the Romantics are down there, because even just to take emotion or just pleasure or whatever is kind of the baseline, but not strive towards anything higher, right? Just being content to be where one is in that moment, right? So I think it can represent all kinds of things. When I read it, I think immediately of the three stages, and that the cellar would represent the aesthetic stage. But I think it's a broad enough kind of metaphor that it could represent anything, where we don't want to move from something that we cling to.
Strikes me a little bit too that one of the things that I've thought about, and this reminds me of it, is that at different times in my life, I've wanted somebody to tell me what is right and what is wrong in no uncertain terms. So that I can do the right thing, And then I can feel good about myself and know that I'm on the right path. And the older I get, the more I realize that there really isn't a black and there isn't a white. It's all just shades of gray.
Yeah.
And it was so much easier when it was black and white. And I know some people that have gotten into adulthood, and there are certain branches of Christianity that pretty much adhere to a really black and white focus. And I think that ties into Bonhoeffer's cheap grace a little bit, because there's not any discernment, it's all decided for you. And if you don't have to wrestle with it, then you're also not responsible. You're not responsible. And whereas I think with the shades of gray, there's a lot more responsibility. So that to me, this is like babydom, you know, so you're washed and fed
right.
And when you crawl up now, you know, there's all kinds of pitfalls in the next level, and probably even more on the top floor. It's a lot farther to fall.
Did they ever talk about the discomfort in the basement?
No, I think for him, well, what's interesting is, for example, in his book Either Or, he talks about the aesthetic, if we're thinking about it as the aesthetic stage, he says that there's something, for example, the person who gets wrapped into their own melancholy, he says that they can start seeing their melancholy as being something that's pleasurable or that they're attached to, which is really interesting, because usually we think of that as something that we wish to avoid or get out of, but he says there's some kind of seductive lure in the melancholy that one wishes to stay there, and it becomes a pleasure thing. Yes.
Have to go back to
comfort and familiarity.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, I wonder if he isn't missing that piece that I think on the surface that appears to be the basement is really comfortable for these people, but I think the reality is in there is also discomfort and dissatisfaction and
yes,
searching
yes.
for something
yes.
else.
Yes, and so when he talks about that, he talks about it, I can't think of the terminology right now, but this kind of untethered existence, he says, is never satisfied, right? Is constantly seeking, searching, and unsatisfied, right? And what you were saying reminded me also of something that I learned this year. I was talking to my colleague who teaches Greek, and we were talking about Jesus' command to love God with your heart and your soul and your mind, and I asked her what mind was in Greek, and I had always thought of it as being some kind of intuitive reason, right, that is just revealed to you, and it is apparent in your reason, kind of like Aquinas' notion that it's just obvious that God gives us reason and boom, it's right there, we would know that he exists. But she says no, that the word that the Greek uses, word for mind that's used in that passage is actually discursive reason, which is one that has to do with dialogue and inquiry and questioning and curiosity and discussion. And I think that that's really fascinating, because then I interpret it as that you have to love God to drink philosophy. That's how I read it, that it's not something that you can just say, I got it and I'm done, but it's something that you constantly have to wrestle with and struggle with and talk about and think about and contemplate and reflect on and, yeah, keep it going, so that it's never easy and it's never set.
Yeah. What, the heart, the mind, and the soul, what were the heart and soul?
I don't know. I didn't get that far because I was so interested in the mind word. But one thing that she did say that I remembered was that that the soul was seated in the stomach, or the heart was in the stomach. So I think it was the heart was in the stomach. So like when you have heartbreak and you can feel it in your stomach, right, that gut retching kind of thing, that had to do with different organs than we associate with. The heart is here, but for them it was some other place, and the soul was located in some physical spot that had reactions. So and encapsulated all of the experiences that we have.
Doesn't the King James Old Testament and stuff use stomach instead of heart?
I think that's, yes, and I think that may be closer to the literal translation of those terms.
In some place, I thought I was taught that the heart is like what we think of as the
it's
mind.
A mind.
Not
and
the
then death. The and the soul was stomach or something like that. I need to go back and find that. But I was just so my learning curve went way up when she was talking to me about the mind one, so I'll have to go back and
one thing that I find interesting about the way the words that you were describing for mind require community.
Yes.
So it's not just
yes.
It's not just you isolated all by yourself
right.
figuring it out. It's got to be you working with
right.
other people.
And it can be engaged with texts or people from an earlier time
yeah.
or through discussion in the classical form of philosophy that was established by Socrates was a dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it had to be done in conversation.
So is this picture was this published?
This was illustrated for this particular book on parables that came out I think in the '80s.
Oh, so this wasn't something.
So this wasn't something that he was familiar with. It was rather just a depiction then for the text. Yeah. For the collection.
Not a self-portrait.
Well, no, I was just thinking, I mean, about, because the picture looks like, you know, he's
yes.
throwing a party, but he's hoarding it to himself, and
party of one.
It's not quite not much of a party.
Yeah. All about me.
Yeah. Solitaire drunk.
Okay, so we've got 5 minutes to do the Wild Goose. This is Howard Hawks' favorite, so I had to do it. I don't know if we'll have time to discuss it, but we'll have time to read it at least. Can somebody read this one? It's on page 389. It says,
"The
Wild Goose, a Metaphor."
Anyone who knows even a little bit about bird life knows that there is a kind of understanding between wild geese and the tame geese, regardless of how different they are. When the flight of the wild geese is heard in the air and there are tame geese down on the ground, the tame geese are instantly aware of it, and to a certain degree they understand what it means. That is, they also start up, beat their wings, cry out, and fly along the ground a piece and awkward, confused, and disorder, and then it is over. There was once a wild goose. In the autumn, about the time for migration, it became aware of some tame geese. It became enamored of them, thought it a shame to fly away from them, and hoped to win them over so they would decide to go along with him on the flight. To that end, it became involved with them in every possible way, tried to entice them to rise a little higher and then again a little higher in their flight, that they might, if possible, accompany it in the flight, saved from the wretched, mediocre life of waiting around in the earth as respectable tame geese. In the beginning, the tame geese thought it very entertaining and liked the wild goose, but soon they became tired of it, drove it away with the sharp words, censored it as a visionary fool devoid of experience. Let's see if I can get that right page.
It's 390.
And wisdom. Alas, unfortunately, the wild goose had become so involved with the tame geese that they had gradually gained power over it. Their opinion meant something to it, and Sumarama, the wild goose, finally became a tame goose. In a certain sense, there was something splendid about the wild goose, what the wild goose wanted, but it was, nevertheless, a mistake. For this is the law. A tame goose never becomes a wild goose, but a wild goose can certainly become a tame goose. If what the wild goose did is not to be commended in any way, it must above all unconditionally watch out for one thing, that it hold on to itself. And soon as it notices that the tame geese have any kind of power over it, then away, away on migratory flight. The law for genus is this: a tame goose never becomes a wild goose, but on the other hand, a wild goose can certainly become a tame goose. Therefore, watch out. Christianity is not like this. It is true that the true Christian who is under the Spirit is as different from the ordinary man as the wild goose is from the tame goose. But Christianity does indeed specifically teach what a person can become in life. Consequently, there is hope here that a tame goose can become a wild goose. Therefore, remain with them. These tame geese stay with them, occupied with only one thing, wanting to win them for the transformation. But for God in heaven's sake, watch out for one thing. As soon as you see that the tame goose began to have power over you, away in migratory flight, so that it does not at all end with your becoming like a tame goose, blissfully sunk in wretched mediocrity.
Your humor.
So, time's up. No. So, what do you think of this?
Amplifies who we feed, the black dog or the white dog.
There was a critique of general Christendom in Denmark, like the common masses are the tame geese, and he's standing out as the wild goose. So there's that tension between the herd mentality versus a more inspired state, which jumped out to me.
It's almost like, you know, the wild goose represents freedom.
Yes.
In Christian, we have lots of freedom, in which we don't take advantage of, because freedom doesn't mean Holy Spirit directed on what we do. But the tame goose is kind of like, could have been a wild goose that went into lethargy, or kind of like stopped living a full life for the potential that God wanted us to live. And we can be influenced by these kind of people around us. We have to be careful of the evil spirits of Satan kind of want to get us into a lethargy state where we don't want to grow anymore to become God's wild goose, or really fully mature Christian who's always looking for new experiences, growing in not only physical, mental, spiritual, and gaining closer to God. So become fully mature people, strong enough, and we can be able to ward off the spirits of wanting to be tame and live in a little closed box and not want to fly into the unknown. You know, so let's be wild but God directed.
There were a couple parts where he talks about what it is that actually traps the wild goose. What was that?
Caring about what they said.
Yes, about the opinions of the other ones. Right. There were a couple times where he talks about that. And it's interesting because it seems as if the wild goose enters into relationship with them out of love, but then ends up becoming worried about the opinions that they have of the wild goose. Right. So it seems like it enters in for the right reason, but then what keeps them trapped is not.
It's hard to be a voice in the wilderness. That's a hard thing.
You know, he says the tame goose is never going to fly. I never heard him get over that. You know, and I used to have a cartoon on my wall. It said, never try and teach a pig to sing. So all it's going to do is irritate the pig and you're going to get mud all over you. You know, and it was just kind of funny and so forth. But it's also... you know, how do I want to say it? I'm just losing the word. I think I'm so superior, and those stupid people out there.
Yeah.
You know, that's wrong. I mean,
yes.
he's yes. Got something wrong there.
Yes. So there is something that smacks of elitism. Right?
That's a word. Yeah.
And the whole issue that Cindy was mentioning, right, of entering into community. So I think this passage in particular, he's trying to warn about the dangers of entering into it and being changed by it in a way that prevents you from being really who you are.
Conforming to it.
Yes, and conforming to our...
You can add to the community, and that's part of what we need dynamically, but to be conformed to the community, to lose the self.
See, I didn't take it the way you took it, Daryl. I think what he's saying is, I mean, the example, God is calling you to, you know, you see something that your community's not doing, and so you speak out. We should be caring for the poor, or we should be sharing our possessions. I go, wait a minute, I don't want to get, quit talking like that. He's saying, don't lose your way, don't conform.
Keep talking.
Well, and he does say, yes, Christianity does indeed specifically teach what a person can become in life. Consequently, there is hope here that a tame goose can become a wild goose.
He says Christianity is not like this.
Yeah.
Right? So he makes the metaphor, but then he specifically says Christianity is not like this because there is that hope.
And therefore remain with them, these tame geese, stay with them, occupied with only one thing, wanting to win them for the transformation.
Oh, okay, there it is.
But watch out. Yeah.
If they start overpowering you.
Yes. Fly away.
Have you guys heard of this story where, like, when the Iraq War started, there was I think he was a veteran, and he would stand on the White House lawn with a candle, and people said, you know, the president doesn't give a rip about you and your candle, dude. What are you doing here? Yeah, you're not going to change the president's mind. You're not going to change the nation's mind with this one candle standing out there. He said, oh, I don't hold the candle to change the president's mind or the world's mind. I change it so the world doesn't change me. You know, that this is one light in the darkness. And I care, but I know that I'm not going to influence you. But I'm also standing firm in what I believe so that you don't take away my belief, that I remain true to myself. And I think that sort of almost ties in pretty well with what he's saying there.
We need, as Christians, to be a light. We're each an individual light in the world, and if we all light, the more lights, the more influence that we're going to have on the world and the people who are the souls who are lost with no direction. So, but that's why we need to have community and fellowship with one another, because if you can't isolate our light, it's easy to go out.
But I think we really have to define Christianity, because I really think that Christianity is one of the major problems in the world. That as a group, if you really get down to it, the Christians are the problem, or a huge component of the problem.
All right, now stop talking.
But it's true, we do it to ourselves a lot. We make our own problems because we kind of maybe want to help God out or something. I don't know.
Can you explain?
The Iraq War, the weapons industry, the consumption that comes from Western Christianity, the belief that we don't need to worry about carbon dioxide because God isn't going to promise not to wreck the world again.
I'm not hearing that from the Christian community.
I think that...
You're listening to the wrong ones.
I think that 85% of the people in the United States...
Well, I don't listen to Fox News, so whatever.
Yeah, maybe you're referring to the general concept that most people, whether they're Christians or not, believe they live in a Christian America, but that's wrong.
I think they define themselves as Christian, but certainly that is within organized churches also. The structure is there. It's right there.
It is interesting that he has, at least in this passage, he speaks about Christianity, and I think that's your point, Peter. He does not say to be a Christian means. There's a difference. Mm-hmm. He seems to be talking about a broader thing than to be a Christian.
Culturally Christian as opposed to...
No. Christianity as a far broader experience. And I think you're right. We need to know more about how he defines Christianity. Can you answer that? Is it for him a...
So he rejected the church at the end of his life. He outright rejected the worldly expression of the church. And I think that's why, Peter, I think you just channeled Kierkegaard in what you said. Because I think that he would have said right on, that's totally exactly what's happening. That it's, that it has become its own conformity machine, right?
And antithetical to the true teachings of Christ as Kierkegaard saw it.
And is that what's happening today with the decline of the major churches? I mean, and people are fleeing from it in a lot of respects, decline to the congregations because they don't see it as true Christianity, or they don't see it, you know, as being helpful.
Christianity is an organizational political structure, you know, which is used by a lot of the world to represent all Christians, which is not true. Their perception is not reality. So, but there's the individual true believer of Christ, and which is the true Christian, which a lot of the only the people are going to know it is probably as on a one-to-one basis of us each sharing our light. But it's a major problem because we just spoke people out there talking about Christians, but they really have never met a true Christian sometimes and see what God can do to a person. But isn't it the Christian church, the Christians, quote, who are out there, you know, carrying out the gospel to feed the poor or visit the gospel of Matthew, Mark, say. So, but there is a perception that's we're battling that's not true, because it's defining Christian as a group, as religion, but we're, as a personal Christian, I look at myself as this personal relationship between me and God, you know, and which is only can really help relate to a non-Christian, whether it's the tame duck to the wild duck. I'm the wild duck, and I know the tame duck who's not a believer, but they have a tough time making that step of faith, you know, where they have to decide in their mind, in their soul, if they want to become a servant of God. So it's a complex issue we're dealing with here is, how do we live as true Christians in this world of many religions, so many people think Christianity is no different than anything else? So we do have a... So we do have our work cut out for us to be servants of representatives of Christ.
I think there's something too significant about domestic geese. Because a wild geese would probably live its whole life and not end up on somebody's dinner table unless he got a little buckshot. But the domestic geese were lined up getting ready to be slaughtered for, you know, Christmas goose or something like that.
And the tame goose, which is also included in the reading, talks about the ones that end up being on the table.
And it's interesting that he came from a greater community and he saw the greater world. And these people, these goose that were tame and set up to slaughter, had a very small understanding of the greater world, and he was going to try to enlighten them. But what happened was when he set their, what their thoughts or their opinions of them were, that he became a part of their community, and then he just became more and more tame and set up to slaughter. So I think that might be like towards the end of his life where he was, you know, the more and more he wanted to distance himself away from the domestic goose.
That fits into the idea of majority rules, you know, the group larger than the one wild goose.
I think it ties into the allegory of the cave, actually, because the tame goose, is he thinks he's got a life, but the but the allegory of the cave, you're seeing a shadow of what your life could be.
Right. Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.